meetings for Tuesday, June 7th. Committee, we were prepared today to listen to 1,000 Friends and the Dash 4 amendments, but those amendments are not ready, and so therefore they have asked to delay their presentation until tomorrow. So we will do that. Also, Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Chandler are prepared to go through the Dash 3s with us tomorrow. But we were preparing to do that, part of that today, but now we don't have anybody to show up with the amendments. So, committee, hopefully each of you have received the survey results as requested by Representative Smith. Is there, the chair doesn't have anything on the agenda for today since the Dash 3 or Dash 4s were taken off the table. So, any recommendations from the committee as to an area or someone you wish to have testify? Each committee member can certainly request anyone they would like to come before the committee at any time during these work sessions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
One suggestion might be to ask if there's anybody in the audience that has anything that they want to add to this discussion that came specially today for that.
Is there anyone in the audience who is prepared?
Anyone but Mr. Grimes.
That took care of that.
Is there anyone who wishes to speak to the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I in personal conversation with you the other day, I brought up an issue that I think we might want to consider in some way, and that is, and I think I broached it in our last discussion, that oftentimes when there is property that is outside the urban growth boundary, and it's mixed farm and forest woodland, that it seems to me that the thing that many of our people in Oregon want to do is preserve open space, preserve the green belt. And to my way of thinking, we need to consider the possibility that we are able to do both to some degree. That if there's pasture in an area that really isn't good farmland, it may be resource land or very poor soil, that some houses can be put in by placing them, by clustering them, as we're talking about in 3120 now, and putting them in back in the trees or in an area that will not impact greatly the farmability of the open space. And the other thing that came to mind is there are a lot of new technologies, or there are several new technologies, that allow for waste treatment in rural areas. Waste treatment by small diameter pipe rather than huge sewer pipe, water pipe, and that maybe some of these technologies could be brought to bear in allowing small clusters of homes rather than having septic tanks all over the place, have one small package system that would deal with a few homes, three, five, whatever. And that whether we want to inject that into this bill or not, I don't know. But I think we need to be looking in the future to those types of things that would allow people the right to live where they want to live and yet retain the livability of the farm, the workability of the farm, and be able to continue the EFU use even though there are people living in the area. I understand the problems of some of the farmers being up against major incursions of people that make it more difficult to farm. But I'm not talking at this point about the high-value farmland. I'm talking about farms that more than likely are not going to be able to support a living on that farm, whether it be 20 acres or 50 or 100 acres. That's a weekend farmer from here on out, as far as I'm concerned, and not a person who is by definition a true farmer. So that's the thought that maybe if we have time to discuss some of these items might be brought up to ameliorate the need for to allow people to be able to live outside the urban area and yet urban growth boundary, but still retain the EFU intention of what's out there.
There is a piece in the Dash threes that does address the urban growth boundary issue. Part of that also could be into a question that Representative Smith brought up before we began the meeting, and that is in whether you're dealing with a tract of record or a lot of record. And Bob Rindy, could I ask you to come up? He just whispered, "Oh no." Bob, just so we're on the same track, bad poor terminology. Could you reiterate to the committee and explain the real difference between lot of record and tract of record?
Mr. Chair, Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation Development, and what I actually whispered to Ronnie, but to my left, is that this is a question that he is very well versed in, and I'm not sure I asked him to come up here.
Good afternoon, Ron, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Are you talking about tract of record as it was proposed in the Senate 1037 and the existing lot of record law, or just sort of generically what the difference in that terminology might mean?
What's the committee's pleasure?
Or both?
I think all of the above.
All of the above.
All right, well, let's start with the generic version. If you use those terms, lot of record versus tract of record, lot and parcel in Oregon law have specific meaning. They're usually one unit of land, either that was partitioned lawfully or was created by a deed or land sales contract prior to the time there were any planning and zoning requirements. A tract is defined as a lot or parcel, or let's see if I get this right, one or more lot or parcels in common ownership. So I might have three parcels or three lots that I own, and that would be considered a tract. So tract of record would mean, as usually it's referred to, I would get one dwelling for the tract, which means all three of the parcels. If you wrote it to say a lot of record, then I might be able, depending on the terminology, get one dwelling per each one of my lots. And I should follow up and say lots are created by subdivisions and parcels are created by partitioning under Oregon law. A subdivision is four or more lots in a calendar year, and parcels or a partition is three or less. Does that help?
I have one question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. Can you describe what common ownership might entail? Because the way I understand it is if just one corner touches another piece, it's considered owned by the same.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, generally that's the way it is. I don't think the statute talks about contiguous ownership, and it's left to the counties. I think most of them, if they touch at a point, will consider those contiguous. I think there's maybe a few that require a little bit more continuity, but certainly if two units of land are touching or side by side, that would be contiguous. And then it's left to the jurisdiction at this point under the law to decide whether the ownership is the same, you know, whether, and you get into some of the same issues we've had to deal with Measure 37 about, you know, Mr. and Mrs. own this one, and Mr. Jones owns this one, and trusts and corporations and all of those sorts of things.
Follow up?
Follow.
On the ownership, then, isn't it the way the jurisdiction writes it is possessory interest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of any county at this point that has defined ownership more specifically. I think they've left it as ownership, at least in the current lot of record law, and they will determine looking, you know, they'll go to county council and they'll look to see under Oregon property law what constitutes ownership and commonality. But I think most people look at who actually has the possessory interest.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're on major 37. Could be better controlled on track rather than a lot of record. Is that correct? If you wanted to contain the growth in a claim, it could be done in a track, but it would be very difficult to do in a lot of record. Am I correct there?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, I think you end up with fewer dwellings if you did it on a tract basis as opposed to a lot-by-lot basis, because if I had three lots that I owned, if you wrote it as lot of record, I could potentially get one dwelling on each of those lots. If I did it based on it being a tract, I would only get one for the three.
Okay. Is a tract of record something that has to be done, recorded in the county, or let's say you're sitting there with 10 lots. Do you have a choice to sit there with 10 lots or one tract, or do you have to go do something to get the one tract designation?
Mr. Chair, if you wrote the law, I think at the time the person would make application, they would look to see whether there was a tract, whether you had one lot or 10 lots, and then would determine what you were qualified for. And by recording that decision, they would know at that time which lots were affected as part of that tract.
And who awards that designation?
Mr. Chair, that's done at the county level as part of that land use application.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
So a lot of record means you could build one lot on one building on each lot. Okay. And one and a tract would mean you could build one lot or one building for all of the lots. All the parcels.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if you wrote it that way, I think when people talk about tract of record, what they mean is you get one dwelling for all the lots that you have in your tract, and if you wrote it as lot of record, it would be one dwelling on each one of the existing parcels.
Following up on what Representative Smith asked, that the lots would all have to be contiguous in order to make them one tract?
Sure, Representative Anderson, yes. Tract is one or more lots or parcels in common ownership.
Okay.
And then maybe it says contiguous.
Common ownership or common?
Or contiguous. In contiguous ownership. I think it's the terminology, so.
And is it possible to have multiple tracks, Carr?
Representative Garrard, Chair Garrard, yes. I might have a cluster here and a cluster here, so you can have separate tracks, but as soon as they're contiguous, they all become one track.
Representative
Armstrong. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think all of us have met with, at various times, the people who are bringing to us Dash 3 amendments. Was it your impression in the discussions that both Tract of Record and Measure 37 appeals or applications could be made, you could take your choice between one or the other? Like a little explanation of how you would see that. Would there be a difference between a tract of record application and, say, a measure 3120, measure 37 initiative application?
Sure, go ahead, Representative Anderson. I'm not sure because I've seen so many versions of 3120 and I couldn't compare with that with a concept of tract of record because there's so many different variations in there.
Section 19 of the Dash 3s, I think, is where you want to go.
Section 19 of the Dash 3s?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, we might want to just make sure that question is on our roster for tomorrow when the proponents of the H3s are here.
Mr. Chair, the other key principle that we didn't really discuss here, when we're talking about lot of record or tract of record, we mean as of a certain date. And that's what the of record is really shorthand for. And so the issue here is that part of the negotiation is what is that date. And so as one of the trades or whatever we want to call them in 1037, you saw the notion that, and I think that's what was being referred to here, is that an owner of property might have a choice of if they own the property on a certain date, and the question is what is that date, let's say 1995, they might have the option of a tract of record and not have to go through the 37 claims process. It would just be automatic if they had ownership back to that date, or alternatively, they could let that go and go through the 37 claim process. I think that's what the notion is. Again, it's being discussed here, and then the question being whether it's lot or tract of record and what that date might be, I guess is probably all of that is simply negotiated, because it would be up to you as to how you would choose to write that.
Do you think it's apropos for us to put tract of record into 3120? Or to handle it as a separate issue from the DLCD?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not going to volunteer whether it's apropos. I think it is one of the things that, I know it's one of the things that's been discussed by the various parties. And as I think, as Mr. Shetterly mentioned yesterday, we are doing our best to try to bring the parties together to some solution. And I don't know that we have, at least at this point, to my knowledge, we're not asserting that that has to be there or doesn't have to be there.
Okay. Yesterday, Director Shetterly pointed out that judicial review is one of the areas that he felt was okay in 1037. Would you just elaborate the judicial review portion of this for us as to what your position is?
Mr. Chair, I don't feel qualified to do that, especially without it right here in front of me. I did read through that yesterday. I think I can summarize that the issue, there are issues, it's not entirely clear as to how judicial review would transpire under Measure 37. So I believe that just in general, the notion is here that it would be a very good thing for legislation to clarify that for all parties involved. And there is a number of issues on that were negotiated as part of 1037 that I think have made their way into the bill, or at least the -3s, I believe that you have. But some of those, most of those details are not parts that I'm personally familiar with and should advise you on. I don't know whether, Ron, whether you would want to try that, or whether there may be someone in the audience who's more familiar with those details.
Ron, do you feel like...
Mr. Chair, just in general, I would agree with Bob. I think what I've focused on some parts of the bill, and Director Shetterly and Richard Whitman from DOJ have worked on this, but I think what this fleshes out are the issues of how soon you have to file a case for judicial review of a decision on a waiver, what the record is, who the parties are, those kinds of issues. And I would agree with Bob. I think all the parties involved, I think, have felt this was a good clarification. Because at this point, all you have in Measure 37 is if 180 days is up and your property is restricted, you can go to circuit court. And all the issues about how soon you can file and who can file and who has standing and what the record is for the decision and whatnot, and what the nature of the judicial review would be by the judge, I think that's what they've worked on spelling out here.
And that was in 1037, as I recall.
There was a section on that, 1037. As far as I know, what's here is the same.
Well, again, I'm just looking at the list of various items that the Farm Bureau, the agency, Mr. Chandler, Mr. Day, and Thousand Friends all discussed yesterday. in, again, trying to whittle down the areas where we may have already have some kind of associated agreement that we can maneuver in. And it would appear from testimony yesterday that the transferability issue is there with everybody, that everybody we talk to is willing to go and discuss this thing and try to work out something that everybody can live with. I'll ask your opinion rather than just repeating things that are told to me. In your opinion, so you're not held on this thing, and if you don't care to answer, I understand. Under Measure 37, if there is no transferability, if the Department of Justice position is held in the courts, if we do nothing and the courts uphold that decision, what happens to Measure 37 claims?
Mr. Chair, as I would understand how Measure 37 works, if a waiver was granted to a property owner that they had an ability to go back and get approval for a use permitted at the time they acquired their property, if the opinion from DOJ on transferability is correct, then that individual or that owner who got the waiver, so to speak, would be able to exercise it and get approval. At the point they transferred the property to a new owner, as I understand it, then the old rules would come back into effect because there's a new owner and the waiver can only go to the claimant and the person who owned the property. So as soon as it's sold, the waiver goes away.
So what happens to whatever they built?
I think if they built something, it would remain. It would then be, I think, it's what happens now in Oregon law. A lot of times people have a house that was built under one set of rules and the rules later changed. And I think each jurisdiction deals with it differently. It might be, there's language in 215.130 that allows existing uses to continue. They're commonly referred to as non-conforming uses. Oregon law does not use that terminology in the statute. And you're allowed to continue, you're allowed to expand and improve that property as long as you keep bringing it up to code.
But you'd never be able to sell it.
Mr. Chair, no, once you built, let's say you built the dwelling, you could sell it. The issue on transferability, that as I understand it, is if I have a lot and I have the waiver, if I sell the lot, the new owner can't exercise whatever was gained under the waiver. Once the waiver is acted upon and you've gotten the land use approval and you're vested, you could build or you could sell the house. I've heard people suggest that, you know, the house might have to be torn down, but I don't know of anything that would lead to that conclusion.
Thank you for that. I think we're kind of treading through fact and fiction here. What's real and what isn't real? Bob, did you want to
add? Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing on this. We are, of course, operating under an opinion, that's Attorney General's and not a court opinion, so I do think you're right. We're speculating to some extent. I think it's fairly clear that if someone has a vested right and they've got a waiver and they've built something, that they can then sell that and the new owner can continue with this. Where this mostly becomes an issue is subdivisions. And many of the Measure 37 claims, it turns out, a large number of them, are about subdivisions. And very likely that owner, whether it's a farmer or some other landowner, in many cases may not be willing or able to develop that subdivision to the point where they would have a vested right or build the thing before they sell it.
Okay, if you will, let's walk that scenario through. Just the way things set right now under Measure 37, and that you are awarded a claim for a subdivision. Walk the committee through this at this point, that you want to go ahead and sell the land to a prospective builder who's going to construct a subdivision on that property. What happens under Measure 37?
I'll try. Mr. Chair, answering that question under the guidance from DOJ about non-transferability, and thinking of a couple of claims that have already been approved, if the current limitations on land divisions are waived and I'm entitled to go back and apply to the county for the partition or subdivision of my property under the laws as they were at whatever point in time we're at, I can do so. If I simply sell the land with the waiver in hand before I partitioned or subdivided it, it's my understanding that the new owner would then not be able to act under the waiver and go in and get partitioning and subdivision approval. Secondarily, if I act under the waiver and get approval for the subdivision and then sell the lots individually, any new owner would be subject to current land use regulations for the issue of whether or not you get a dwelling, and would not benefit from the waiver. So the only way someone would get full benefit from the waiver would be if they partitioned the property and they got the approvals and developed each lot individually. That's how I understand it would play out.
So the individual property owner could, in essence, go build the subdivision themselves, and it would be fine.
Correct.
But when they wanted to... Okay. My mind's going right to where you are, Steve.
Question following up on that. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You could co-venture with someone as long as you retained ownership until that building was in lot were finally sold.
Joe Gerard, Representative Anderson, I believe so. I mean, the Measure 37 talks about having an interest therein, so I've heard all kinds of speculation about what kind of relationships could occur, but of the claims I've seen and the language that we've been developing, as long as there's a qualified owner who gets the claim and they've got an interest in the property, they can exercise whatever rights they've gained under that waiver, regardless of the fact that there may be someone else who's bought in an interest later on, but that later interest gets the benefit of the claimant's earlier interest in the property.
So there's no
waiver they've gotten.
There's no amount set that you have to maintain, no amount of interest, a minimum percentage of interest in a partnership, an LLC, or anything else that they form, huh?
Chair Gerard, speaking as a non-lawyer, but it's my understanding that there is no limit. The Measure 37 says any interest therein, and that's been interpreted. I've seen some claims where people have varying degrees of partial interest, and yet it's the earlier date based on that interest, even if it's partial interest in the property, that sets the waiver date.
So as long as you're alive, you can own 1% all the way through, and you could transfer and sell the property as often as you wanted to.
Chair Gore, that probably so. There will probably be all kinds of interesting arrangements that are made. I'm not an expert enough to even speculate on them.
Mr. Chair, that's probably the case, is that there are probably a dozen different ways that have been discussed that may, in the end, moot the question of whether you can or can't transfer. But I think it's also understood that there's a cloud over this. I mean, it's not real clear. It's not well understood what exactly would happen if there's not transferability. And for that reason alone, I think it has risen to the top of the list of most of the people that you've heard from.
But most importantly, we don't know what the financial world, what their approach to that kind of a scenario might be as to whether they would loan money or not loan money.
Correct.
Given that scenario.
More specifically, one claim I'm aware of, Mr. Chair, we had an individual who bought got some property from the family, and then later on got married, and then at a subsequent time, she and her husband bought the land from the rest of the family, so they finally made it whole. And the way the claim sets up is, because her partial interest goes way back, she has a valid claim back to that earlier date, and the husband only has an interest to an earlier date, so to the extent they can develop under that, based on that earlier date, they need to stay married or the wife needs to stay alive.
Scenario, and it's, I think it's, we have the makings of a good motion picture here.
Mr. Chair, there are makings of many motion pictures in the claims we're looking through.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't invest in such a picture. I can't imagine that the general audience would find this fascinating, but anyway.
It's all, as someone who has reviewed a good many claims at this point, in some cases it's almost a little embarrassing, because as you go through this family ownership information, you're finding out lots of information about families and which brothers and sisters don't get along and who swap property and all kinds of stuff. And I think a lot of the lawyers joke that they say, well, this, when we get into this trusts and wills and estates, it's all the stuff they did in law school, and they call that real law, not land use law. And they have to go to a whole other set of people to try and answer these questions.
The committee is fortunate we have Representative Ackerman here.
Right. Who understands both real and land use law?
Yes, he's become an expert in both. Any other questions, Representative Anderson?
Can I just pursue one other area? One of the areas that's interested and concerned me is the far end of the initiative. What do you all think? Does this go forever? Should we have a 5-year, a 10-year ending on it? Do you have thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I know it's an issue of discussion, and it's an important issue. The measure itself has a 2-year cutoff from prior claims on restrictions that are prior to the measure itself. But even that is not crystal clear as to how and when that might operate, since it operates based on when the restriction was enacted or, quote, first enforced, itself being that itself being some language that's not clear as to what we don't know exactly what first enforced necessarily means. And so all of that, I think, falls into the realm of provisions under 37 that are not crystal clear, that are likely to be litigated, that do create confusion, and that is one of them. Does the measure end after 2 years from when it was enacted for prior claims, or does it keep going? And I think, you know, the interests of many parties are to try and bring some certainty to that.
If I might raise the chair, Representative Anderson, if memory serves me on the claims, that there is that 2-year cutoff for filing a claim based on a regulation that was enacted before the Act, but then there's some other language that says there's an additional 2 years from the point that regulation is actually applied in a land use decision. So that 2 years can extend out further based on when it's actually applied. I don't have the language in front of me, so I'd have to go back. I know it's one of the things we have laid out in our staff reports.
Representative Ackerman.
Now, as I see the prospective claims, it's sort of like a constant rollover of time, because every time there's a new land use regulation affecting somebody's property, whether it's now, 6 months from now, 3 months from now, 2 years from now, a new claim is generated. So we're going into perpetuity, unless we have a statute of ultimate repose. Just talk law talk, okay? Thank you. But I don't see any end to the prospective claims, do you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't believe so. I think you're accurate. If you enact something new, it pushes that 2-year timeline out further again based on that regulation.
There has not been a lot of conversation about that particular area or effect of Measure 37, and that is the future.
Mr. Chair, Chair, I think there's been conversation, and of course there's various groups talking about this.
Well, that's all you guys do all day. And talk about land use. It's becoming our thing now, so.
I think you will find that that's an issue that does, as we get into some of the amendments, you should likely hear some more on that.
And I believe the discussions that took place on the Senate side and that are ongoing have talked about building in some deadlines for getting claims filed, so you kind of know what the universe is.
Would you care to address separation of powers and explain that to the committee, that portion?
I'm not expert on constitutional law at all.
We were both getting ready to say no at the same time. I guess that was it.
The chair thinks he's in the Judiciary Committee right now.
I've learned everything from you, so
I gave you 6 credits from Duke Dawson
Clark. Oh, thank you very much.
I'm always willing, Mr. Chair, to answer land use law questions, even as a non-lawyer, but non-constitutional questions.
Okay, fair enough. Minimum lot size. Farm Bureau brought that up.
Comment? You mean?
Yes.
I don't remember. I think what Don was suggesting yesterday was because the minimum lot sizes in farm and forest zones are specified in statute, ORS 215780, that in his view you can't waive those, and that's why I believe he was suggesting tract of record as the appropriate remedy. Unless there was some ability for the legislature to grant an agency the authority to waive a statutory provision. And then that gets back into separation of powers, and I'm beyond my expertise.
Mr. Chair, there are a large number of land use regulations that are for which the measure applies, either derive from local or from local government regulations or state administrative rules, but as this is the issue where there are a few provisions that are in statute, and so then the separation of power question arises when we ask whether the agency can grant a waiver to what is essentially a legislative act establishing a regulation.
If this legislature gave each county the ability to designate their own minimum lot size. An opinion? Good or bad?
Mr. I haven't given that much thought. And obviously, as you can tell from my slow response, I don't know that that's been part of a discussion that we've been involved in. Obviously, there's that and any other number of solutions are probably being discussed, but I don't recall much discussion on that one.
Okay. Chair Berard, what I would say is that over time, the question would be, what's the standard that they base the minimum, that they come up with a number? In Senate Bill 101, all land divisions had to be reviewed for conformity with the Legislative Agricultural Land Use Policy, which is very general, in ORS 215-243. Statewide Goal 3 required that farm-related parcels be appropriate for commercial agricultural use. And that, I forget what year, somewhere in the 80s, that was actually put into ORS Chapter 215 as well. What you found was counties would try and determine what was appropriate for commercial agriculture, case by case. It's a general standard. There was a lot of litigation over it. And at some point in time, I guess it was 93, there gained some consensus that the 80-acre minimum lot size was an appropriate size generally for maintaining land in large enough units for commercial agricultural use. And I guess I would agree with Bob. I don't think there's been any real discussion on changing that standard at this point.
Anyone else on the committee have a question?
Well, maybe just a follow-up on where do you see the problem in minimum lot size? I'm trying to...
Well, Mr. Schellenberg brought it up yesterday in reference to the separation of powers question. Don, would you like to come back up? I think this was one of your recommendations.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. It occurred to me that the reason for the separation of powers is because there are state statutes that would prohibit a Measure 37 claim if the state agency didn't have the power to waive state statute. So in order to preserve that separation of powers, it was my thought that we would have to find a different way to accommodate the minimum lot size issue in particular. And so the proposal that I put forward there, based on our Farm Bureau policy, that we let the counties then do away with the ability for them to waive state statute and allow the counties to determine what the appropriate size for minimum lot sizes would be, and that would give those people who would otherwise have a Measure 37 claim on based on minimum lot size, give them an opportunity to voice their opinion about what kind of minimum lot size are ought to be in their county. And that was the basis of it.
Does that mean that if I have a 37 claim, it allows me to put in a small subdivision, five lots? Would that minimum size be determined at the time I file the get the 37 claim approved, or would that go back to the point in time where the regulation affected my ability not to build that subdivision? What standards are we employing, the earlier standards or the later standards, if a claim was approved or approved?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, the way it would have to work would be that you wouldn't be able to do a Measure 37 claim based on minimum lot size. But in return, the counties would have the ability, instead of having to stay with the 80-acre minimum lot size on cultivated farmland or 160 on rangeland, they would then have the authority, statutory authority, to determine what minimum lot size they did want to apply in different parts of the county, whether it be cultivatable land or rangeland or maybe different minimum lot sizes, even in different parts of the rangeland or different parts of the cultivatable land in the county. It would be an after-the-fact issue that they would have the opportunity to deal with.
I'm not satisfied my question was answered, but I'm just assuming that I have a valid 37 claim and I'm allowed to do a five-lot subdivision. Okay, and the regulation I got set aside was enacted in, let's just say, 1995. Do I then apply 1995 standards on my lot size, or do I apply 2005 lot standards?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, you would apply the 2005 standards.
Okay. I don't really see that in the draft. I see something floating around. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? These three gentlemen. Thank you all. Really educational. I have a note here that John Foster is here from Estacada. Small Woodland Associate member would like to speak to the committee today. We're not, in essence, taking public testimony. Is it the committee? Do you want to hear this gentleman? What he has to say?
Yes.
Welcome, Mr. Foster.
Over there. Thank you very much for making your exception. Like I said, I am John Foster. I'm the first vice president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We introduced a bill this session that's a little bit different than 37 that we've been working on for a long time, and I'd like to share a little bit of that for you in a minute. But first, I want to explain that our members did not take a position on 37 once it passed.
That took a lot of courage.
Well, a lot of people want to change it, as we hear constantly what's going on, and we just didn't. We want to stay neutral on that. However, we did have a land use bill, and I'd like to tell a little story about that, and I'll be real brief. wheat. The template test, which I think a lot of you have heard about, and it turned out, passed in 1993, and turned out to be kind of a headache and very impractical for small woodland owners that wanted to live on their land. If you owned 180 acres or more on the west side, you could build outright. If you owned 179 acres, there's no way in the world you'd ever pass a template test. At 35 acres, you might be able to. So there was a big gap for a lot of our devoted woodland owners that wanted to live on their property but could not. And so we thought, if we arrange or if we propose something where they could live on the property, then we should have some caveats that are pretty good public policy to go with that. We met with representatives from the Farm Bureau. In fact, Don came over to us, LCDC, before our Governor's Affairs Committee, Department of Forestry, land use planners, quite a cross-section to get different opinions. And when it done, we still felt that the family forest landowner, and I won't go into why because we didn't even have one up on the committee here, that should have the right to live on their land and help manage their land. It makes it a lot more efficient. In our bill, which was Senate Bill 676, introduced on our behalf by Senator Schrader, we made one change on the east side, and I want to share this because it's kind of important. If you own farmland on the east side, you have an outright ability at 160 acres to put on a dwelling. If you own forest land, they want 240 acres. So what would people want to do with the forest land if they wanted to dwell? They want to change it to farmland. So we thought it probably should be the same, so 160 acres. Then we had heard a lot of, in the different people we talked to, in Jackson and Josephine County, you have increased fire risk, and they got real low productivity farmland, and so you could not, you had a better chance of meeting the template test in those two counties down there with the higher risk than you do in the rest of Western Oregon. So we proposed, this was a proposal, that we want Jackson and Josephine County with the same rules that we have on the east side. And then on the west side now, we proposed to build clear down to 35 acres. However, there are a few caveats that we put in there. You must be within the jurisdiction of a local fire district. I mean, fire is very important to us, too. The dwelling should meet all applicable building codes and fire safety standards. And only one single dwelling would qualify per parcel. We weren't looking to break it up. It was just the right to build on that parcel. And then the owner, and this is more technical language, but it's the right to farm and forest. The owner record on his deed to agree not to bring action to abate or enjoin in a nuisance the lawful or customary agriculture or forest practices. We thought if somebody's going to move out there, don't let them stop us from managing our forest in the way we have been traditionally. Then, as politics are, the one other thing we thought we should put in there because it's a big incentive. We in our bill, we wanted the land fully stocked before you could put the housing in there, the house on there under the Forest Practices Act. It's probably one incentive that would make more headway on getting these underproductive forest land stocked than anything else I've seen proposed around in a long time. In 37, Major 37, that wouldn't be practical at all, but that was one of the things we did. Right now, we're losing, a study by Oregon State University showed we're losing about 20,000 acres of forest land, not to developments, but to industrial forest land. The non-industrial forest land owner is just selling off.
They can't live there. They can't be there to manage it. So it's got to be a big headache. We didn't think it was good public policy to have a bill such that was passed in 1993 that's encouraging something that are having consequences other than what we thought should keep it equitable for both industrial forest landowners and forest land and non-industrial forest landowners. If you have, I'll be, that was my brief statement. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. We've been working on this for about 10 years, and with the last year, we made a few different changes because anybody that explained to you about the template test, you just kind of scratch your head. We wanted so everybody could understand and know what we were trying to do.
Any questions from the committee? Must have done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The for those of you that may have just come in, the committee was anticipating taking testimony today on various amendments, but none of the amendments have been prepared on time. So we've been continuing our own self-education course, and so we have about 10-15 minutes before we have to go back. On the floor, is there anyone present who would like to address the committee? Mr. Kafuri.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafuri. I wouldn't plan to testify today, obviously, but I was interested in Representative Anderson's comments or questions, and the last one that you mentioned, Mr. Chair, had to do with allowing counties to decide their own sizes. And it occurred to me that we have a solution, and I want to talk about that in a second, but I want to talk first about the problem. And the problem, I represent land use planners, and we are trained, disciplined, and used to, in our professional work, making planning decisions based on gathering lots of information and having all the facts in front of us before we make a decision about how things are going to be. What's happening to the legislators in this legislature is that you're being asked to do land use planning at a massive scale by anecdote. Somebody said, I saw a problem here in this county, and I think there may be a little problem over here in that county, so let's draw something big that's going to affect the whole state.
About March, we got tired of that.
Mr. Chair, what I would advise you to do is to take care of the immediate problems. I know that you're working in that direction, the technical problems that arise. We do have a solution. The solution is Senate Bill 82, which you may know as the Big Look, and I want to make a pitch for that. A lot of those kind of questions ought to be answered not today or next week in this legislature we're trying to get out of here, but the question of what do we want the land use system to be like in the future, how do we want to deal with areas where there's rural and urban interface or a rural interface that happens between farmers and foresters or between people who want to graze and people who want to build summer homes. Those kind of things that you're raising, what can we do about small communities that are 5 or 6 houses in an isolated area? Ought to be dealt with in a broad picture. How is it going to affect the state of Oregon? How many people are there around the state? How much land is around the state that this would affect? So we can make those kind of decisions in a rational way. As I said, we do have a bill in front of the legislature that will help us get there, and I would urge your support, this committee's support, for the bill.
I think that's been brought up. Representative Green had brought up. Representative Dunlap. I think Senate Bill 82 is sitting over in the Senate, like everything else in the world is at this point, and doesn't seem to be doing well. It's got a price tag of almost $1 million, and that's obviously what's slowed its progress a little bit.
I think, Mr. Chair, also that there's some disputes between the House and the Senate, and I think that this is one of the things that there's going to be some discussion as things close up. I hope that this is part of that discussion.
Well, it certainly has been brought up by numerous other people in testimony before the committee in regards that a very important ingredient will be an interim group that continues on with this same effort. Maybe undoing what we do, maybe just looking at how to redo the system, but there are a lot of folks who certainly go along with you, Mr. Kafuri, in thinking that 82 is the proper vehicle at the moment to back up what's being done at 37.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Or are you going to
close now?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just wondering, as we go through these drafts over the next couple of days, I think we're going to see some things, some questions we have, some things we want clarified, and some amendments that we, as a committee, may see are necessary. I would rather we discuss those up front rather than, say, me coming back with my amendments, and every time I ask for an amendment, I'm going to get 32 pages of text. I wonder if we could discuss those openly, and if there's a sort of a consensus, then we could, you know, ask the amendment. But if it was going to be something just totally wouldn't fly, it might not be worth generating the extra work. I just wondered how you...
And that was the chair's intention.
Pardon?
That was the chair's intention.
Okay. Thank you.
Was for this committee to work, and I don't know whether we want to call it mix and matching.
Mm-hmm.
We've got three very big amendments to this bill, and I'm quite sure that all of them have areas of merit that this committee will be interested in. But it will be this committee that determines what sections of those amendments will be useful to the committee. So we will listen in the next 2 days. We will listen to the proponents of those amendments, and then we begin the process in this committee of selecting what we feel we need to do to accomplish the goal in the short time period that we have it. So that's agreeable with everyone.
Are you working under any timeline of which we should be aware? I don't
I would say that we probably have, this being Tuesday, we have at least a week to do what others have not done, and
well, we're good.
Any other questions from the committee? Tomorrow, if you want to attend the Mark Hatfield, we can either decide to adjourn as a committee and then re-adjourn after it's over, or it depends on how many members wish to go, etc. That's at 2 o'clock, so we'll discuss that then when we meet at 1:15 tomorrow.
I'm planning to attend.
And you are planning to attend. Anyone else?
Yeah.
At this time? Okay, it's 2:03. It sounds like we better just, maybe we should just not even convene until later. Well, we're shot on that too now, so.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll convene at 1:15 tomorrow, and then we'll recess to allow members to attend that. Okay.
I'm going to spend lunch here. Our lunchtime will start early.
Depends on what time we get off the floor. It's these days.
Why don't you announce it on the floor?
We could. Announce what?
What time we meet tomorrow.
Oh, okay. We can do that.
Because if we're not in work session, we can always meet.
Yeah.
Can't we?
How do we do this for the speaker signature?
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part, is we have to have the speaker's approval.
For all the times we have convened after our posted starting time.
I know.
We can once convene before it.
Well, we only need one person in here to wrap us in at 1:15, right. And then we can recess till after the Hatfield.
Great.
Okay, House Committee on Land Use is adjourned.